Reuven wasn't there when the other nine Shvatim decided to sell Yosef. And the way that we know this is from the words of the Pasuk, Vayashav Reuven. Reuven returned, which means he was not there at the time. And the question is, why was he not there? So Rashi explains that Reuven had run away to do teshuva for an earlier sin that he had done. And Rabbi Salavitch elaborates on that and says that earlier in his life, Reuven did something where he wasn't properly respectful to his father. He wasn't properly considerate of how his actions would affect his father's feelings. And at the time, he thought that the consequences were minor, were limited, were contained, that it wasn't going to have a ripple effect. However, when he was arguing with his brothers and trying to convince them to leave Yosef alone, one of the things that he said was, think of how our father is going to feel. What about our father's feelings? And the answer that he got was, you're a hypocrite. You didn't care about our father's feelings when you did what you did with Bilhah's, tent. And so if you didn't care, what right do you have to rebuke us for it? And at that point, he realized that what he had done was much more serious than he'd originally thought. And that's why after his failed speech, he ran away to do teshuva. This is the beginning of a theme that occurs a number of places here, which is the power of anybody to influence other people, and particularly the power of a Bechor, whom the other brothers, look up to. He wasn't considerate of Yaakov Avinu's feelings. Now his brothers are learning from him. They're also being inconsiderate of Yaakov Avinu's feelings. Now, when Reuven comes back to his brothers after having run away to do teshuva, and meanwhile the brothers sold Yosef, he says, Hayeled einenu, va'ani ana aniva. Literally, this means the boy is not, and I, where will I come or where will I go? Again, it might just be an expression of anguish, but the Or HaChaim gives a deeper explanation, and he says, obviously, when we go back to Yaakov Avinu, and Yosef is missing, he's going to say we need to organize a search party. And who's going to be appointed in charge of that search party? The Bechor, right? Because the oldest usually has the most responsibilities. And Reuven said, if Yosef was still in the pit, I would have known where to search for him. But now that you've sold him, now that Yosef is gone, where in the world will I go to look for him? That's Hayeled Einenu, Va'ani Ana Aniva. And we pointed out that the Bechor, according to Halacha, has two unique privileges. One of them is that the Bechor gets a double portion of the inheritance. And the second is that younger siblings need to respect their older siblings. That's part of the mitzvah of Kibud Avaim, not just respecting your parents, but respecting your older siblings. Obviously, the Bechor gets the most respect. All of the siblings are younger than he is and have a mitzvah to respect him. And the question is, why? Just because he was born first? It's not as if he's the biggest tzaddik. It's not as if this was a choice that he made. Why does the Bechor get these privileges? And, based on the Or HaChaim, I think this makes a lot of sense. Because my father, always told me when I was growing up that privilege and responsibility go hand in hand. They go together. The more responsibilities you have, the more privilege you get. If someone has more privilege, then probably they also have more responsibilities. The Bechor is going to be the one who's responsible for the search party. He's the leader of the search party. It's going to be on his shoulders to bring Yosef back. The Bechor is the one who's expected to be a role model for his younger siblings. He's supposed to model respect and sensitivity and compassion. If he doesn't, the consequences can be very, very serious. And because the Bechor has such serious responsibilities, he also gets extra privileges as well. Now, another idea about the Bechor. The Shvatim decided to deceive Yaakov Avinu about what happened to Yosef. They didn't want to tell him that they had sold Yosef as a slave because they thought he was coming to murder them. And instead, they shechted a hairy goat and they dipped Yosef's coat into the blood of the goat. And it's interesting because they did not do this as soon as they sold Yosef. They did not do this as soon as they sold Yosef, threw Yosef into the pit. It's much later in the story that they decide to carry out this deception. In fact, what comes immediately before this deception is that Reuven comes to them and his clothing is torn. And he's probably sobbing and hysterical. Hayaladinenu, where are the boys gone? Vani ananiva, what's going to happen to me? And only after they see Reuven like this, with his torn clothing, do they decide to make the deception. And so, I saw that there were some contemporary people who suggest that maybe the Shvatim were not planning at first to deceive Yaakov Avinu. They were planning to say, yeah, he was coming to murder us, so we defended ourselves and we sold him as a slave. But when they saw how Yosef's disappearance affected Reuven, and how Reuven was thrown into grief and anguish and mourning, they realized that it might be too much for Yaakov Avinu. Maybe he'll have a heart attack. And they realized that they needed to do something to soften the blow. And that's why they decided to carry out this deception. And so again, the way that a Bechor conducts himself, he has to be a role model. He has to, you know, the way that he acts has to give people insight into how the parents would react. And that's why Klal Yisrael is called Bini Bechori Yisrael, the Bechor of Hashem. Because we're supposed to act in a way that's a role model for the rest of the world, that gives the world insight into the values of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the values of compassion, justice, fairness, of generosity, of empathy, of love, of so many other things, loyalty, you know, which are emphasized all over the Torah. We're supposed to be role models of all of those and more. Bini b'chayri Yisrael, the way we conduct ourselves, supposed to give insight into the mind, kaviyachol, of Avinu Shebashamayim. Now, when Yaakov Avinu saw the bloody coat, it says that he tore his clothing and he put sackcloth, which is an itchy material, right, under his clothes. And he mourned for Yosef for many days. And all of his sons and all of his daughters got up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And we talked about, you know, how does a person comfort a mourner successfully? And what are some common mess-ups that people make when they're trying to comfort a mourner? So sometimes people get into their head that they gotta say something, they can't think of what to say, and they end up saying something dumb. Some people say, it's not such a big deal. Look how many other children you have. Look how many grandchildren you have. That's a big no-no. Does not make a person feel good. Does not make a person feel comforted. No big deal. What, your loss is no big deal. Come on. Come on. It's a big deal. A second mistake that people make is they think that it's a time to be philosophers. I know exactly why it happened. It was because of this Avera, that mess up, the other mistake, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it. Right, because a punishment for this or for that, also not helpful. That's not comforting. Does not belong in a house of mourning. And finally, third thing that a person should not say in a house of mourning: come in, I know exactly how you feel. Right? I know how you're feeling now. You're feeling terrible. No. That's not comforting either. It sounds like being a show off. Right? I'm so empathic. Right? I'm so smart, I can tell how you feel. It's not a helpful thing to say in a house of mourning. What should a person say if they open their mouth at all? The point of being Menachem Avel is to show the mourners that you care about them, and to show that you're there for them. And so the only things that you should say are things that that sort of communicate those messages. So you could say, is there anything I can do for you? Do you need me to learn Mishnayos? In the memory of the departed? Do you need me to cook something for you? To buy food for you? Do you need me to coordinate something? Should I map your floors after people track mud on them? The point is to show that I'm there for you. If you need anything, just call me up and I'll be happy to help. That's really like the best thing that you can say. It communicates the message that you care about the people and that you're there for them when they need you. And that's really the point of Nichum Avelim. And so again, we don't know, what Yaakov Avinu's children did. We hope it was the right thing, but nonetheless, Yaakov Avinu refused to be comforted. And he said the words that he said when he refused to be comforted were Ki Eireid El Bini Avel Sheola. And there's two versions of the Targum in terms of what those words mean. The literal translation is, because I will go down to my son in mourning to Gehenim. The second version of the Targum changes the word El, which means to, from the literal translation to a figurative translation. And it says, because I will go down because of my son in mourning, right, to the grave. And the Kli Yakar, seems to assume, he's wondering, like, why does Yaakov Avinu think that Yosef is in Gehenim? And why does he think that just because Yosef is in Gehenim, that he's going to go follow Yosef to Gehenim? And the Kli Yakar explains that Yaakov Avinu was blaming his parenting. He says, Yosef must have done a terrible Avera if he died so young. He was 17 years old. He must have done a terrible Avera. And if Yosef did a terrible Avera, that he deserved to die young, then I must have made a mistake when I was raising him. And so part of the fault is mine. I'm partially to blame for Yosef dying. And therefore, if Yosef is in Gehenim, I'm going to go to Gehenim right after him. I'm going to go down to my son in mourning to Gehenim. And we just, we pointed out it doesn't mean that, every kid should blame his parents for all of his averos, but rather just the opposite. What it means is that everybody should take responsibility for their share in a mistake. And of course, Yaakov didn't mean to say it's all my fault and it's not Yosef's fault at all. But Yaakov didn't either say, something? Yosef messed up. It has nothing to do with me. I did my job properly. I'm perfect. And if Yosef messed up, it's all on his own shoulders. That's not what Yaakov Avinu said. He stood up and he said, something? Some of the responsibility might be mine, and I'll fess up to my part in this, or my passable part in this. We pointed out that, this is really the reversal of the chait of Adam HaRishon. Right? In Gan Eden, so we had, Hashem said to Adam, why do you eat from the tree? He said, Chava, she made me do it. And so Hashem said to Chava, why do you eat from the tree? And she said, the snake made me do it. And it was basically a blame game. And there are some Mefarshim who say, if they hadn't blamed other people, if they had taken responsibility for what they had done, that was wrong. I did the wrong thing. How can I fix it now? If they had done that, they may have never been kicked out of Gan Eden. And so when Yaakov Avinu, he could have put the blame on Yosef, but he didn't. And that was a tremendous act of heroism and of leadership. And this sort of leads into the next parak. The next parak is a very, very difficult story. the story of Yehuda and Tamar. It's very embarrassing for Yehuda what goes on in this parak, for a number of reasons. And you know, the Mishnah says that usually prakim that talk about things that are embarrassing for heroes of our history, we usually don't teach those prakim in public. But this particular parak is not on the list of embarrassing things that we don't teach, and the Gemara is troubled. Why? It's pretty embarrassing for Yehuda. Why are we allowed to teach it? And the Gemara's answer is amazing, and it says that even though Yehuda did something that was very wrong in this parak, but when the time came and he needed to fess up, he needed to step up to the plate and take responsibility, he did exactly that. He got up and he said, "It's my fault. I did wrong. I'm going to try to fix it now." And that's such a heroic thing that it's worth teaching. It's worth teaching this embarrassing story just to marvel at Yehuda's heroism in confessing to what he did. We pointed out that you know, David HaMelech and Shaul HaMelech, they both did an Avera when they were king. But when Shaul was confronted, Shmuel HaNavi said, why do you spare, and why do you do this? He said, "It's not my fault. It's the people's fault, the soldiers. They did it. They made me do it." And he lost the monarchy. As opposed to David HaMelech, who also did a pretty serious Avera when he was a king. And when Nathan HaNavi confronted him, what did he say? "Chatasi, I sinned. You're right. How can I make it better?" And that is really the main attribute of leadership, according to the Torah. It's a willingness to fess up for one's mistakes, to take responsibility, to accept, you know, blame and guilt when they're deserved. And you know, this is a parak that really teaches us the greatness of Yehuda, that he really stepped up to the plate and did this. There are two instances where this appears in the parak. Number one, in the wake of Mechiras Yosef, it says Vayered Yehuda mi'et Echav, that he went down, he demoted himself, or perhaps was demoted or accepted a demotion, because he realized he had done something wrong for Mechiras Yosef. And then later on, when he did whatever it was with Tamar, and she was being taken out to be executed, and she said, "You know, whoever these tzitzis belong to, that's who the father of my babies are." When Yehuda saw the tzitzis, he recognized that it was his tzitzis, and he stepped right up. He said, "You know something? She's right. I'm the father. Call off the execution." It was incredibly embarrassing for him. He might have suffered a tremendous loss, you know, in terms of social standing or in terms of business, but he did it anyhow, because he understood the importance of taking responsibility for our mess-ups. What exactly happened that led up to this whole story? So the parak tells us that Yehuda had three sons. The first was called Er, the second was named Onan, and the third son was named Shelah. And we pointed out that the names of these children, they foreshadow the events that occur later on in the parak. The word Er has five different meanings. You know, the positive meanings, which are probably the meanings that Yehuda meant when he gave his baby that name. It could mean energy, it could mean a wakefulness. But it also has some negative meanings. Letters of Er, I and Resh, if you flip them around, they spell Ra, which means bad. That foreshadows that some bad deeds will be done later in the parak, and some bad consequences will follow in the wake of those bad deeds. The letters Ayin Resh, when they appear in the word Ariri, it means childlessness. It's one of the forms of Kares, Kares va'Ariri. And again, what that might foreshadow is that there's going to be some childlessness, some loss of children in this parak. Indeed, Yehuda's two older sons, Er and Onan, both die within the first 10 psukim of the parak. In the word Erva, the letters Ayin Resh also signify something that should be concealed, or perhaps wasn't properly concealed. That also, it foreshadows that later on in this parak, there's going to be things that ought to be have kept private, but were not. And whether that's the actual story of what Yehuda and his sons did, or whether it's, you know, the actual thing that the Yehuda's sons did, it was a breach of privacy, or what Yehuda did and Tamar did. But all of these things are being foreshadowed, perhaps, in the name of Yehuda's first son, Er. And the second son, Onan, again, Onan has two different meanings. The shorish of On Could mean strength, which is probably what Yehuda's wife intended when she named her baby that, but it also comes from the same root as aninos. Aninos is the most painful stage of mourning in between the death of a close relative and the burial. It's the most painful stage, of coping with grief, and that's what aninos means, pain or suffering. And again, it might be foreshadowing that later on in the parak there's going to be many painful events and lots of suffering, as indeed we will discover as we continue to learn through the parak. So what exactly happens? Er gets married. He's very young. He might, be just around bar mitzvah age, definitely not much older than that. And, very often when people are that age, during the teenage years, they have yet to reach their full mental maturity. Sometimes they have immature ways of dealing with things, of looking at things, of relating to people. And the Ramban explains that this is exactly the sin of Er, that he related to his wife, to Tamar, in a very immature way. In other words, one of the important lessons that the Torah teaches about how to relate to women is that women are people and not pleasure providers. And there are so many mitzvos and stories in the Torah which teach us that when a person relates to a woman as a pleasure provider, he looks at her for pleasure, he listens to her for pleasure, he touches her for pleasure, he hangs out with her for pleasure, right, or anything else, that's not appropriate according to the Torah's worldview. That, is called, zinus ha'ozen, or zinus ha'inayim, or zinus ha'etzbaos, right? I mean, it's relating to a woman the way that one would relate to a mizonos, right, to a piece of food, just being as a pleasure provider, and the Torah considers that to be abhorrent. But at the same time, right, again, you're talking about a 13-year-old, he might not have been mature enough to relate to Tamar as a person. And the Ramban says, oh, she's there to give me pleasure. It would be a pity if she looked less beautiful. And so Er did the sin of not having children in order not to cause Tamar to lose her beauty and to be less pleasurable for him. This was a tremendous, tremendous mistake for somebody on the level of holiness of Er. And because of that, Er died. In the wake of Er's death, Yehuda says to Onan, you should marry your brother's widow and perform the mitzvah of Yibum. What is the mitzvah of Yibum? The idea is that when a man dies without any children, it's a mitzvah for one of his brothers to marry his widow. The deeper understanding of the mitzvah of Yibum, or one of the philosophical or moral lessons that we learn from Yibum, is the following. Every person has certain values that their neshama is very attached to. Whether it's chesed or tefillah, right, or learning Torah, or shatnez, right, or bikur cholim, or burial of the dead, right, or whether it's a particular holiday, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Chanukah, Purim, Tu B'Shvat, or any other set of values, whether it's Medinat Yisrael, right, whether it's Ahavat Yisrael, there are so many values in the Torah, and different people, different neshamos connect better to different values. Again, we keep all of them, but perhaps we go far above and beyond what's expected of us when it comes to one or two things, and each person, it's something unique and something that should be celebrated. And when a person dies without any children, to sort of kindle with the same enthusiasm that they have for their particular, mitzvos, it's a sad thing, because it means that enthusiasm now perhaps is lacking an advocate. It's missing somebody to sort of spread it in the world. And the moral lesson from Yibum, right, is that it's important, if you have the surviving brother and the widow and they have a child, they're supposed to raise that child the way that the dead brother would have raised him. And it's not always so easy, right? You can imagine if the dead brother was a Mets fan and the brother who survived is a Yankees fan, And he's going to have to raise his children to be Mets fans, even though he's a Yankees fan. That's really hard. What's he going to do? How's he going to take them to ball games? Right? How are they going to get along? Right? When it's a Subway Series, they're going to be rooting for different teams. It's really, really difficult. And this is something, a conflict that Onan experienced. The pasuk says, "Vayeda Onan ki lo lo yihyeh hazara." Onan knew that the children that he had with Tamar wouldn't be his. He wasn't going to be able to raise them the way that he wanted to raise the children. But again, morally, that he would be bound. Again, it's not part of the mitzvah of Yibam, is just to marry the widow. But he understood that to fulfill the deeper lesson of the mitzvah, he would be required to raise the children to be, to be Yankees fans. And that was very, very difficult for him. And so he also did the aveira of not having children, and Onan also died from that. At that point, Yehuda realized that something was wrong, and so he told Tamar. He said, "Go back to your father's house and wait there as a widow." And Tamar said, "Why?" And Yehuda said, "Because Shelah is not yet old enough to marry you. So go back to your father's house until Shelah is old enough." Now, there was more in Yehuda's mind than what he told Tamar. In Yehuda's mind, he wasn't just thinking, "Ah, Shelah's too young to get married." But the pasuk says that Yehuda was worried that Shelah would die just like Er and Onan had died. And that's the reason he was thinking, even though he didn't tell Tamar, "I'm scared to let Shelah marry you because maybe he's going to die also." The Ramban sort of puts two and two together, and he says Yehuda understood that Er and Onan could have avoided their averos if only they had been a little older and a little more mature. Like, keep in mind, Er related to Tamar in an immature way, as a pleasure provider, not as a person. If only he had been another 10 years older, if only he had waited until he was 23 to get married instead of getting married at 13 or 14, maybe he would have done the right thing. And so the Ramban says that Yehuda was saying, Shelah, if I let him marry Tamar, he might not be mature enough, just like his older brothers weren't mature enough, and he might do an Aveira also. So let's wait until he's older, until he's more mature, and then he'll marry Tamar. And if he's more mature, hopefully he'll be able to avoid repeating his older brother's mistakes. Now, Tamar thinks that Shelah is mature earlier. Yehuda thinks that he's not going to be mature until much later. I mean, that's going to set the stage for the continuation of the Perek, where Yehuda doesn't call Tamar back to marry Shelah. Tamar sees that Shelah is already 14, 15, 16, whatever the age is. She thinks that Yehuda's never going to call her back. Really, Yehuda's just waiting until till he sees that Shelah is mature enough to enter the marriage properly. And this is where we'll pause for a moment, and Yirtzeh Hashem continue a different time.